My name is Bert Weisenberg.
Love Talk Radio.
My name is Bert Weisenberg, and I'm here to talk with Tyson Cornell about publishing my new novel, In Velvet. Tyson also published my first novel, Inside Passage, and we'll be discussing how the publication of In Velvet builds on and relates to the sales, the publication process, and the experience of working together on Inside Passage. Before writing novels, I produced feature films, including Ghost Story, starring Fred Astaire, and Raggedy Man, starring Sissy Spacek. Before founding Rare Bird Lit in January of 2010, Tyson Cornell spent 9.5 years as director of marketing and publicity at the legendary Sunset Strip independent bookstore, Book Soup, where he coordinated events and sales for thousands of authors, celebrities, and politicians. At Rare Bird Lit, Tyson works closely with best-selling and debut authors to maximize all efforts of book promotions. Rare Bird Books is an independent publishing house formed by Rare Bird Lit's founder, Tyson Cornell. It has 3 imprints. Through these imprints, Tyson publishes literary fiction, political nonfiction, crime, mystery, entertainment, narrative nonfiction, cooking, and humor. In January of 2013, Tyson published Inside Passage as a Vireo book. In Velvet will be published in the spring of 2014, also as a Vireo book. Hello, Tyson.
Hey, Bert. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to this, actually. Let's start by talking about our decision to publish In Velvet as our next project together rather than the second novel in the Corey Logan trilogy.
Well, that's an interesting question because, when we started talking about the possibility of publishing a book and then a couple books or a few books later on, it was the idea that you had this Corey Logan series, this trilogy of 3 books, and we had a wonderful time working through Inside Passage and launching that, and it wasn't that long ago, and we have some wonderful momentum. And then we decided to shift gears and move forward on this standalone general fiction title called In Velvet. And why the question of doing that as opposed to moving on to your next book teaser in the Corey Logan series? I think that it is, first of all, it's an extremely strong title. It's, In Velvet is a powerhouse. And I think strategically it's really important for us to go out and show the world that that you are pretty versatile, that you have this really powerful ongoing narrative, but then there's something behind it as well. And that was really, among other things, my main intent on pushing In Velvet forward.
Well, I remember discussing both books in Los Angeles, and I think that we both had the same instinct that somehow In Velvet would expand the marketplace for the next in the Corey Logan trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
That it would reach, and maybe it would be helpful for you to speak to the difference between genre fiction and general fiction, and the shape and size of those different markets.
Sure, sure. In some ways, it's simple marketing, and in other ways, it kind of gets a little complicated. But genre fiction has a wide audience, but it's also limited to that audience. When people look at novels that have recurring characters and it's really about the ongoing series of that narrative. For some reason it tends to really be separate from people just going out and wanting a good book. And can be very polarizing, and maybe one aspect of it is that an entire series can be intimidating, or if somebody knows that Inside Passage it also has two books that aren't published yet, there's a reluctance for them to get started, get hooked, and then have to wait. With a general standalone, you obviously don't have that problem. Now, the weird thing is that's actually a lot of the draw towards genre fiction, is that people can get wrapped up in that world, and people, you know, the same way people get wrapped up in TV shows and miniseries.
And they look forward to coming back to that world for when the next book comes out. And my hope has always been that people who read In Velvet first and enjoy the sort of big scale will really enjoy coming back and reading Inside Passage, simply not because they know the series, but because they liked In Velvet so much.
Yeah, exactly.
So what is it that you think makes In Velvet so compelling?
Well, it's an epic in a lot of ways. You know, I don't know if it's the perfect way to describe the book, but I always think of it as Michael Crichton meets David Lynch in Montana. I think that gets a chuckle, but it's really an interesting way of
Well, David Lean is there, too.
Absolutely. I don't want to forget him, no doubt. But, it's an interesting general literary fiction title that is fun, serious at times, an adventure story, an entertainment. And it just kind of goes through this cast of characters in Montana dealing with some pretty extraordinary things. And really centers around the whole idea that there's this ordinary landscape and extraordinary things are happening. Wildlife is, and maybe you can describe a little bit more of this, but there are abnormalities happening with the wildlife and things going around.
Well, that's actually how the book starts. And the protagonist is a female bear biologist. And, you know, her grizzly that she's followed for 20 years is denning in June. And people are seeing brown trout spawning in June, which never happens. And there are elk with oversized antlers, like the Irish elk, which is a species that's been extinct for 5,000 years. And it's all in an area of the park that's closed, and ostensibly closed because Rachel's bear is considered a dangerous rogue bear, and she knows, of course, that that's not true. So there's a mystery and a thriller and this abnormal science in this remarkable setting, which is Yellowstone Park, which is, you know, one of the most magical places in the world. And, you know, I started going to Yellowstone Park with my children, you know, over 20 years ago, and we go on horseback trips and the wildlife is just extraordinary, and the physical beauty. And then we also included the thermal features, because I don't want to reveal what's called the science, the Michael Crichton part of the book, but it does relate to the thermophile, which are heat-loving bacteria that grow in these hot springs pools. It's the only place in the universe they may be on Mars, but the only place on Earth where these creatures exist. I believe that's true. I don't know. They may exist in other hot springs elsewhere that I'm not familiar with, but they were discovered at Yellowstone. In any event, I can hear myself getting carried away talking about this, but it's all still very exciting to me.
Well, and what was that initial excitement? Where did that... I mean, can you tell us a little bit about that first moment that brought you there?
Well, you know, a Jewish intellectual from an intellectual family growing up in Chicago, it's the wilderness and the idea of understanding it and being able to be comfortable in that world. And it's a world that has an absolutely, you know, beautiful yet ruthless, you know, the bears take down the elk calves. I mean, that's just the way it is. And there's an order to it. And I began by, you know, regular fly fishing with my son in remote areas. And as we got to know this country, it became very interesting to me that, you know, once you understood how things worked and the sort of natural rhythms, what would happen if things went awry? And how would people understand that? And there was sort of a natural progression for me to start thinking about unseasonal animal behavior.
Do you think now you're thinking about those abnormalities and these? I don't want to say supernatural, but this fantastical world of wildlife. Do you think people that grew up in that environment or more of a rural environment are thinking about those same things, or is it just commonplace for them?
Well, I don't. I think that people are who live in that world, and the people that really taught me about it are very tuned in to cycles, and you know when the birds start migrating, you know when the elk are in velvet, you know, which is a time when their antlers are covered by the brown fuzz, and that it's you know the blood is flowing through the antlers during that time, and it has apparently aphrodisiac qualities. There's quite a large market for it, hence the title In Velvet. And people in that world watch these things, and if something isn't right, they're right on it, and it's an event. I mean, you know, it's like when the weather changes and it snows in L.A. or something.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It does. And how often do you go back there?
I before moving to New York, I spent 50 days a year easily for since Ben was 7 and he's 32 now, so that's 25 years. Now that I'm in New York, I spend 30 days in the summer, and I try to go 5 days as I just did in the spring or 5 days in the fall, so it's closer to 35 or 40 rather than 50 days. But I'd love to start going 50 days again once you become a fisherman, Tyson. We'll have our own annual 10-day trip.
That's great. Yeah, I'm looking forward to making it out there this summer. Can you tell a little bit about what happens then?
Well, you know, the summer is a wonderful time because you have these long days, and, you know, you can fish till 9:30 at night, and there are frequently you see wildlife coming down as you know it gets a little cooler in the evening. You may see elk and deer, and where we fish on the Madison, there are no grizzly bears, so that doesn't have to be a concern. If you go into Yellowstone, you know, there are a lot of people there in the summer, but there are, you know, depending on how patient you are and how willing you are to go into wild country, there's lots of wildlife. And,
well, what are the dangers? What are the dangers in the wildlife? If I mean, if
bears
well, aren't
you know,
really
it, bears are wild, and if you step between a grizzly and her cubs, you could get mauled, and or at least charged, which has got to be one of the most terrifying things imaginable. A 500-pound grizzly bear coming at you 30 miles an hour, and they stop like right in your face, but you don't know they're going to stop.
And they may not
stop. Right. And hence, you know, the popularity of bear mace, because most of a bear's sensory equipment is in its nose. 98%, or I'm not sure I have that percentage right, but it's more sensitive than a person's eyes. And so that if you spray the bear as he's charging or she's charging, the bear will stop on a dime. But you have to wait till he is, you know, 30 feet away or less even. And I've never had that experience, but it's got to be very frightening.
And what are the story? I mean, I'm sure you go into details in your book that that people might be able to explore, but what are some of the stories that aren't in the book that you hear going out there?
Well, you know, you hear all sorts of stories about tourists doing crazy things in Yellowstone Park. You know, the guy that puts honey on his wife's face so the bear will kiss her in the car.
Whoa.
And, of course, she gets mauled. I mean, there are lots of horrible stories about, you know, guys trying to ride buffalo. And buffalo are very wild, dangerous animals.
Now, are there actually buffalo, or are they all bison? That's something I continue to hear.
My understanding, and I'm not expert on this, so I'm not exactly sure what that distinction is. But yes, there are buffalo in Yellowstone Park.
Wow, that must be just fascinating. And they're pretty dangerous.
Well, I mean, they don't bother you if you keep your distance, but they're very powerful animals, and a lot of people get gored. I mean, they're big signs up now in Yellowstone. I mean, people have this idea that it's like you can feed the animals or play with them, and these are wild animals, and they can be unpredictable. And, you know, a lot of times they don't react, but it's the times they do react that a person gets really hurt.
Now, what about the people? You know, I grew up in the city, and I can often be uncomfortable in rural environments, and my mind immediately goes to axe killers and murderers. But you know, I spend a lot of time traveling in northern and western Canada, and up there there are signs that say, "Beware, killer on the loose." And
yeah,
do you ever see any of that stuff in Montana?
I haven't. I found the people in Montana to be extremely helpful and welcoming and generous. Certainly around the activities that I do, you know, generous with information about fishing. And, you know, obviously there are people who are very solitary. I mean, there's areas of Montana where survivalists and so on congregate because it's such wild country. And, you know, in the winter you can't get in and out and they don't welcome new people. But the majority of Montanans, you know, this is a state that really relies on tourism. And
yeah,
they're very welcoming to outsiders. I mean, it's one of their biggest industries. And that's a very nice part of, you know, certainly fishing in Montana and being in the park. And, the, you know, the park is a wonderful place in terms of the people who work there who are, you know, I'm sure the park is understaffed with the recent budget cuts and so on and so forth. And with all of the potentially annoying things that having a million tourists generate, the people are remarkably, open, welcoming, generous with information. When I was just there, I was talking to someone from the Greater Yellowstone Association about the book, and he couldn't have been more helpful in terms of making suggestions of people to talk to and so on and so forth. And that's just something that is normal.
Mm-hmm. And, well, there's that. And then, Bozeman is a college town, right?
Yeah, and so is Missoula.
Okay.
And both Bozeman's an interesting place because it's a destination for people who like the outdoors. I mean, there's a lot of like sports medicine there, doctors who could practice anywhere in the world, but they like to ski in the winter. And of course, there's a lot of people who ski that need sports medicine doctors. And, you know, they like all the activities in the summer. And there's the culture that comes with the university and, you know, all the writers and artists that come to, because they love the country. And same in Missoula. Let me ask you, let's go back for a second to the some of the publishing issues. And let's, as a publisher, I think In Velvet offers unique visual opportunities. Can we talk a little bit about that and what we're, what we've been talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. The you know, I mean, I think that the world of fiction is changing in a visual way. I'm starting to see a lot more visual content in books where maybe even 5 or 10 years ago, you had to have a pretty crazy book to start showing visual elements or images or artifacts or documents. That was, I think that was kind of crazy back then, but now I'm seeing it more and more, and I think the opportunities to do that stuff are being accepted more for general readers. And I think that's something that we want to explore a great deal in this book, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I think this idea of, you know, nature gone awry and, you know, bear cubs with no ears, you know, all of these are hormonal abnormalities, or many of them are hormonal abnormalities, the too much causing mutations and timing changes causing unseasonal behavior. And little things like mule deer with palmated antlers, which are like a moose, are very arresting images, and they don't need to be pushed too far. And I'm very preoccupied with how we can use those kind of things to enhance the experience of the book.
And that's what we're trying to do. I think that's what most authors and publishers really are driving toward. It's is making it experience, making it this other world, even with nonfiction titles. And it's just another way for us to do that. And maybe some of these explorations in print visual directions come from the competing demand of enhanced e-books and people thinking that you can add all these things to the digital component, and then the question arises, what if we did this for the print as well?
Well, you're way ahead of me on this because this is all new to me, but I just think there are raging forest fires in Velvet. I mean, that's part of what's going on in this closed area. And, you know, a forest fire, you know, if you remember in 88, the fires in Yellowstone, there was a lot of controversy over whether, you know, the sort of let it burn naturally, you know, it's part of the natural order and the et cetera, and a lot of people argued against that. But there is something so visually dramatic about a forest fire behind a hot spring that's erupting, a geyser, and an elk with an oversized rack of antlers. I mean, that's just a very unsettling image and beautiful at the same time.
Yeah, no doubt.
And so, as a publisher, this is a two-part question. What is your thinking about how you optimize the impact of the second book on the first and then on what follows? And how does that lead to the timing? which is the decision to publish in Velvet in the spring of 2014?
Well, those are good questions. And I think the strategy is really about volleying back and forth, but also finding a great cohesive commonality between the two. You know, sometimes I'll see this same technique happen when you have nonfiction writers that, in between their nonfiction titles, they're doing novels, or you know, somebody like T.C. Boyle, who has a method of doing a novel one year, short stories the next year, novel, short stories, and I think he's done that since 1980, and he's just in this constant back and forth in a lot of ways. But you have to keep that thread. You know, the author is the brand, the author is the marketing technique, and these are like the Jekyll and Hydes of them in some ways. Sometimes they're really extreme, and in other ways they complement themselves a little bit more. The reason I want to release In Velvet in the spring of 2014 is really because I want to treat it as a major general fiction title, which needs some more lead time than a lot of others, but also because Inside Passage came out in hardcover January 2013, and the technique is to hype up In Velvet pre-publication, launch the paperback in early 2014 for Inside Passage, and then follow that up with a big launch for In Velvet.
Well, I'm very excited about this plan, and let me sort of lead us to wrapping up by talking for just a minute about how our experience working together on Inside Passage will influence our work on In Velvet, and I think we can both speak to that, but I'd like you to take the lead, if you would.
Well, what are the strongest areas for you, before I answer that?
Well, I just think we've developed a very good process of shared decision-making.
Yeah.
In all areas, you know, from everything from the visual design to editing issues to financial issues. And,
yeah. Having these big ideas and how, what are we going to do to take over the world? Absolutely. It's it's interesting. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think that's just the natural way of people working together. And of course, the classic stories of editors and authors working together, I think that's exactly what we're doing. And maybe you don't see it as much now in the industry as it once was, or maybe it's the same and it was just over-glorified in some ways. But, you know, I think that's when the best stuff is created, when you have two people collaborating or multiple people collaborating and building the ideas off of each other. You know, I mean, how many times are we talking and one of us has it made up, we're open to suggestion and having it change, but one of us has it in their head that they really like this idea, or they have one direction they want to go with it, and they're just going, yeah, that's it. And then the other one's going, oh, that's great, but, you know, let's just think about it from a different perspective. And ultimately it ends up changing. And later on, it's really for the best. And if there was one brain conceptualizing everything, I think you'd miss that.
Well, I'm interested in you talking about the sort of classic author-editor relationships. And I think from my standpoint, Well, first of all, I agree with everything you're saying, but I think the experience of Inside Passage was of not having something quite right, and each of us pushing in our own way to get it there, and coming up with something that I'm not sure either of us would have come up with on their own. And I'm seeing that, for example, within Velvet, your suggestion of using chapter titles and then pulling quotes from the chapters, as opposed to numbering chapters, really freed me up to think about the book in a different way, and these sort of define a tone that will allow me to do further writing that I think will enrich the book very much. And, you know, I guess the other point would then be that if you have a history of making good decisions with somebody you're working with, there's a more trust there, and you can sort of get ahead of yourself a little bit in the sense that you can start thinking about things, knowing that they're maybe 5 months away before we actually focus on them. I mean, there's stuff like interior artwork. Maybe, I don't know, it's 5 months away, but certainly not going to happen the next 2 weeks. But we're still talking about it, and that is impacting the writing.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely is. You've heard me say this a lot, and it's just I really have a lifestyle approach to all of this, which can be good and can be bad in certain situations, I guess. A good way of looking at that is that it tends to be a little bit more organic. And the downside is that, when we're working with other publishers on marketing-related things, there's a really tight fiscal campaign timeline, and there isn't really much room for these long-term ideas. For instance, spending a chunk of time outreaching for something that possibly isn't going to have a return until next year or the year after, or maybe even later down the road. However, that's where my mind goes, and those are things that I think ultimately are worthwhile to focus on. For the authors, they tend to be very effective. And as long as they're in it for the long haul and they're lifers.
I am certainly feeling excited about working together on In Velvet, especially after our experience with Inside Passage. And I think that the book will be better for the work process that we've sort of worked out together. So I think that that's something we'll both end up feeling good about. And, you know, we could keep talking indefinitely, but I think that this has been very interesting to me, and I hope to others. I'd also like to direct people to both the Rare Bird website and my website, www.bertweisbord.com, for more information about Inside Passage. And Tyson, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bert. Appreciate it.
We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Talk to you later.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one. No is the saddest experience you'll ever know. Yes, it's the saddest experience you'll ever know. to